This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to Aquariumania. I'm your host, Dr. Roy Yanong, speaking to you from the University of Florida IFAS Tropical Aquaculture Laboratory. Thanks for joining us. Planet aquariums comprised of lush, sculpted underwater gardens or evoking natural settings in nature are a thing of beauty, and experts in aquascaping are artists in their own right. My guest today, Chance Kramer, a longtime hobbyist and award winner in competitive aquascaping, has inspired many hobbyists with his beautiful aquaria. Join us as Chance shares his journey from hobbyist to aquascaping expert and educator. We'll be right back after these messages.
You know the expression, cats have nine lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations, too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Aquariumania on Pet Life Radio. My guest today is Chance Kramer, an award-winning aquascape artist and lifelong aquarist. So, Chance, I always like to start these podcasts with kind of a little bit of a personal investigation into your early years. How did you first become interested in fish, nature, and aquaria?
Well, first, thanks for having me on. Basically, my whole life has been kind of derived from nature. I grew up in a very nature rural area in the woods of Loxahatchee, Florida. So, I mean, I spent a lot of time outside. I spent a lot of time in swamps, just kind of being one with what was out there. So, I mean, nature, I was always brought up with, spent a lot of time on boats and stuff like that. Aquariums came into my life when my mom actually, she got a goldfish tank, and I kind of just got infatuated with the aquariums and stuff like that. And then my own personal aquariums, I found a turtle while I was jogging. This is kind of like what really got me deep into it. I found a turtle while I was jogging one day. I was like 15, 16, and I took it home and got him his own little tank, set him up, and started putting plants in there with him because I read turtles like to eat plants. So I went to Petco, bought some cheap plants, threw them in there, and he devoured them. I went back and I bought more, and I planted them down this time, and he didn't eat them. And they started to grow, but I noticed as they grew, their whole morphology changed. Everything about them, the way they looked originally to the way they look now, and that interested me a lot. So that really started my deep dive into plants and the whole aquarium world is just the watching that change that happens, that transformation from immersed aquatics to submerged aquatics. And that really caught my interest.
Cool. So you started out by having something eating your plants before you realized that you could actually let them grow and kind of
spent a lot of years learning what eats the plants.
That's funny. So so you mentioned that was your very first tank. What was your maybe first fish tank? Did you have fish tanks after that?
Yeah, like shortly after I got the turtle, once I noticed that the plants were growing, I got the turtle a bigger enclosure and moved him out. And then I just decided I was going to keep a bunch of different plants. So I went back and I bought a whole bunch of different plants and a few fish. I think my first like personal fish were actually Oscars, which leads into another fish that eats plants. So I got some Oscars, and they were in there with my plants for a while, and they were peaceful, and eventually they shredded them up, and then it just evolved from there. I went from them to gouramis to tetras and, you know, everything in between.
So I guess you're doing incredible things with plants. So do you still have a fish room, or do you just mainly do plants, or you kind of have combo? What's your sort of current setup?
I do both. So I work full time at my fiance's fish store, Bad Fish Tropical Fish. So I'm surrounded by, I'm actually, as we're doing this right now, I'm surrounded by probably like 5,000 gallons worth of tanks. And then at my home, I have a whole gallery set up where I do, where I keep all my works, my aquascapes and such. And then I have a little rack for breeding. Breeding used to be my priority, early hobby, and now it's shifted more towards the art and aquatic plants. And I also have greenhouses that I grow these guys, the plants, and I grow them immersed in greenhouses as well. Kind of all in.
No, that's great. So before we get into the weeds on aquatic plants and aquascaping, just a few more questions. How did, I guess, you get interested in kind of the business end of it? And also, you talked a little bit about your early kind of forays into aquascaping. How did you kind of get into the whole aquascaping and then competitive aquascaping as well?
Aquascaping started when I stumbled upon this forum called the Bar Report. I was trying to learn more about the plants I was growing as far as nutrients. And the Bar Report was started by Tom Barr, who, if any of you listening have heard of him or know of him, that you know a book, why I decided to learn from it. If you haven't, I would just give his name a quick Google. He's an extremely renowned plant, aquatic plant horticulturalist, a great guy. So I went on to his forum and was searching for, you know, various nutrients and things that these plants needed to try to figure out what I was doing wrong. And I came across pictures of tanks that were absolutely out of this world. And it blew my mind. I got immediately infatuated with the contrast and the depth and everything along those lines. That just unlocked something in my brain. And pretty much from that moment forward, my focus just dove into design and aquascaping and more of an art than actual the hobby end of it. I went more towards the art and science end and spent a lot of time there. But it was really just researching and finding and stumbling across these absolutely amazing tanks from artists out of Japan and out of Korea and out of Europe, you know, various places in Europe. And that's what really got me hooked on it.
So how did you kind of get into the business end? And I'm assuming like you weren't doing aquarium sort of things before your major interest.
No, I'm a computer nerd. So, you know, that's what I went to school for, is computers. But once I started growing the plants and, you know, really learned what they need, they were growing so much. And I was feeding extras to my turtle still at this point, but I still had an abundance of plants. So I started on Reddit, actually, just posting some plants up for people to give away at first, you know, and then I came across a sales post for the same plants that I was giving away, and people were actually making an income, you know, off of the stuff I was giving away. So I was like, you know, I could use this to supplement my hobby a little bit. And so I decided I was going to start posting plants up for sale, and people were eating them up. They really loved the plants I was growing. And so I set up a whole nother tank and decided, all right, I'm going to go ahead and grow some plants to supplement my hobby. Probably 6 months after that, I noticed that some of the plants were growing out of the top of my aquarium. And again, their morphology has completely changed. They're now back into their immersed state. So that triggered that tease in my brain again to get me to want to grow these aquatics on land. So I got a greenhouse and started learning all that fun stuff. And before you know it, I had a whole, I think that one was a small, like 10 by 15 greenhouse, completely blown out with aquatics. So I started a fictitious name, a business, and started, you know, selling plants online and through Facebook and other social media outlets. And it became a very good supplement to my hobby. And I kind of just ran with that.
Can you also tell us, I know you work with or consult with Bad Fish. You're an ambassador for, is it OASE? Is that how you say it?
OASA.
OASA, OASA, sorry. And then what, the APT Trident Circle. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, yeah. So with Bad Fish, I got involved with them. I was commissioned to do a paludarium in the store by the owner, Alexa. And we had spoken a few times before at shows, and I've been into her store prior to that. And we kind of hit it off and just had a chemistry and started talking a lot. And then I kind of always liked the fish store scene and stuff. So I transitioned to in here after, you know, shortly after we started dating, and I started aquascaping tanks and bringing plants in and stuff like that. And I really, what grew on me the most was the customers that come in, the connection that I was able to form with them and helping them achieve their aquarium goals and helping them achieve the looks that they wanted to have in their aquarium. So that really sparked me to dive deeper into the bad fish side of things. And Owaza ties into it too, because it's kind of that same vibe. I got involved with Owaza probably about 6 years ago now. And I was just at a aquarium show and I stopped by and was talking with them, and they knew of me. They knew of some of the stuff that I've done more so with the plants, and they were local. They actually had a headquarters probably 5 miles away from my house. So they invited me over to scape a tank in their gallery that they had there. And the scape I did really impressed them, and they offered me kind of like a creative media partner position at first, and then it kind of transitioned into a full brand ambassador as of late. Yeah, and with APT, the Trident Circle member, that's kind of like a recognition that the owner, Xiaosheng Wang or Dennis Wang, kind of puts out there for aquarists that he likes the quality of the stuff that they do, their work, the way they grow their plants. And he kind of puts that offer out there for folks to be, I guess, brand ambassadors for his brand, as he calls it, a Trident Circle member. And basically, all I do for all of these companies is educate various clients on ways that they can achieve their goals and show them that these products that I work with Owaza and with APT and the plants and fish from Bad Fish in general as well, will make their lives easier in this world of aquariums, due to the fact that they're easy to use, they're simple to establish and get going, and they really help bring out the full function of the aquarium. So that's my main drive, I guess, behind all three, is just to get the word of aquascaping and grow the aquarium hobby here in the United States, just to kind of give back to it a bit, because it's given me so much peace and so much tranquility in my life that I feel sharing this is kind of where I'm at now, to make other people have that same joy and pure happiness that I get from the aquarium world.
I guess I should have had you mention for the listeners, where are you based?
Where is Bad Fish? Where are you guys?
Bad Fish is in North Palm Beach, Florida. It is located off at A1A, a nice store, little store, but we've got a lot packed in here from all sorts of types of hardscapes for probably over 200 different species of plants. I can't even begin to count the amount of species of fish we keep in here, but you know, it's a very, very nice store in North Palm Beach, Florida.
Okay, great. Thanks. So with that background, we should probably dive into the plants now. Kind of wanted to have you sort of give a little bit of a primer for our listeners. I know, and I've had some planet tanks, which, you know, you probably would have like maybe smiled at. I was just happy that the plants like survived. But can you kind of go into maybe some of the, you know, a little bit of intro to the major groups? I think I mentioned to you, that I've had Cryptocrines and Anubias, which are pretty hardy. But if you can kind of talk briefly about some of the major groups of aquatic plants, you know, and also I think in some, you know, when I listen to some of your talks that you have online, you talk about macrophakes as well. Can you address some of that?
Yeah, so I'll actually start there with the macrophakes, because I believe, you know, a lot of the listeners can get a lot more out of this. But there's a lot of plants out there that are sold as aquarium plants, but they're not true aquatics. They'll live short times submerged, but they won't live long term submerged. And the reason for this is they're just not evolved to do that, or they never were at that point. And a lot of shops and nurseries and things along those lines will put these out there because they will live maybe like 2-3 weeks submerged, but they will eventually die. And I call those guys aquatic macrophakes, mainly just for that. They're sold as aquatics, but they're not. But what I found is for every aquatic macrophake that there is, one of them being called purple waffle, you guys can Google it if you want. That one's a very common aquarium plant that you'll see in various big box stores and stuff like that being sold as an aquatic, but it's not. It's a perennial terrestrial plant. But to substitute it, if you just search Hypnus lorenzentina, it looks just like your purple waffle plant. That is a beautiful plant, but it's fully aquatic. It's a true aquatic. It'll grow submerged long term forever if you let it, and it'll always have its beauty and it's that color that people like purple waffle for. So there's plants out there that you can use to supplement for these fakes. And I guess to roll into the groups of things, you know, these plants that I was just discussing, the Hycus laurentina, they fall into the stem plant group. And stem plants are probably the most common plants you'll see being grown in aquarium. That's your Ludwigias, your Rotalas, Pogostamens, Limnophila, Hygrophila. All of those guys are all stem plants. And all stem plants, for the most part, will grow immersed on land and submerged on the water. That's kind of like a cool evolutionary trait that they have. So you can take these plants that you find even on like a dry hiking trail, as long as it's that species of plant, and put it in your aquarium, and it'll grow into a lush, beautiful aquarium plant. The other groups of plants would be like your epiphytes and rhodophytes, which is like your Anubias and Bucephalandra. Those guys, they're a little bit more easy to grow, so less intensive, much slower growing. They could tolerate lower lights. Stem plants are going to look their best in a higher light, CO2 injected aquarium, things like that, to get their full worth out of them. But the Anubias and Bucephalandra and stuff can be grown in a low tech aquarium and kept very, very nice. So, I mean, that's a good simple option, as well as the Cryptocoryne, which falls under more of a rosette category. The rosettes would be like your Echinodorus and your Cryptocoryne. Eriocallan could grows like a rosette, but it, you know, it's more so in the grass area. But they those guys are all pretty easy to grow, apart from Eriocallan. That one's gonna need some CO2. But all of these guys combined into Escape really provide the look that I believe what most people are going for, which is nature. You know, when you go into a river or a stream or a lake or even, I mean, actually, you know, a brackish estuary, you're not going to just find one species or one type of plant. You know, these plants are all dispersed together, and, you know, we'll grow in groups over here with a sprig of something, you know, a vallisneria coming out in the middle of a grouping of Ludwigia repens. That's really what I believe people are looking to create. And I think they get stuck on, you know, picking one grouping of plant. And if you just kind of toss in some other groups in there, it creates a full look and really builds that nature aesthetic that people want.
If you don't mind, like, what would be kind of maybe the appearance difference or biology difference between the stem, the epiphyte, and the rosette you were talking about? Is it more kind of like where they come off, the leaves come off the plant, or how would you sort of like differentiate those?
So a stem plant's going to grow off a stem, a centralized stem that's going to grow vertical. Typically, some stems will creep and some stems will lean, but typically they're going to be growing vertical. And the leaves are going to come off either in a opposite formation, where the leaves are directly opposite of each other on that stem, or they're going to come off in an alternating, where you're going to have a leaf on the left side, no leaf on the right side. It's going to skip down a node, and then you're going to have another leaf. Or it can grow in a whorl, where the leaves basically are whirled down the stem of like a spiral. And those are the primary growth patterns of a stem plant. And they all, you know, as I mentioned, nodes and stuff like that, all the leaves are going to be coming from a node, which is a part on the stem that contains all the meristem DNA and all that fun stuff to allow the plant to grow. And those leaves basically are used as descriptors to classify or to describe these plants. So it's very important, you know, knowing the alternating and opposite and whorl and stuff like that, because that's going to help you identify the plants to make sure that you know, have what you are saying you have. So they'll all grow in that pattern. Rosettes, as I said, like Cryptocoryns and Echinodorus, they all grow from a centralized location of the plant, kind of like a croom, I guess, towards the middle of the plant. And the leaves will grow out like a rose. So you'll have all your older leaves will be on the outside of this plant, and all your newer growth is going to come from the center. So, and they'll kind of fold out like a rose, and that will be your Echinodorus, various Cryptocoryns. Some Cryptocoryns will grow more like a vallisneria or a grass type and send runners and stuff, but for the most part, they're rosettes. And the Anubias and Bucephalandra, the rhodophytes and the epiphytes, those guys, they all grow on like a rhizome, which is kind of like a hard, almost woody stem-like feature that allows for the plant to send out its petioles, which is that little piece that holds the leaf out. It's called a petiole. And all of that comes off of this rhizome, and it creeps. It'll creep across hardscape. It'll creep across the substrate, you know, it'll do all these things and eventually send off new heads from this rhizome. And you can snip these new heads, and that's how you would propagate it. It's just cutting the new heads off the rhizome. And then moss, I didn't even speak to these, but moss is a brophyte, and moss basically is its own little animal. It grows ever more from a single strand and has various heads and points. The morphology of moss is crazy. So it's the taxonomy of it. It's brophytes are a huge class of plants. So, but moss will kind of always stretch and kind of try to cover what it's doing, or what it's growing on to have maximum exposure.
Great. Thanks. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was actually going to ask you about moss. So I appreciate you mentioning that.
Yeah. Moss is an animal.
It is weird. Thanks. Let's take a short break and we'll continue our discussion with my guest, Chance Kramer, aquatic plant and aquascaping expert, after a word from our sponsors.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
We're back and continuing our discussion of aquatic plants and aquascaping with my guest, Chance Kramer, aquascaping expert. So that's really helpful. I'm sure there's folks out there that maybe weren't aware of you know, about the macrophages. And I think the description kind of the different types of plants, you know, is very, very helpful. So I kind of wanted to dive in a little bit now into a little bit more about kind of plant keeping. What would you say maybe beginning and maybe intermediate hobbyists should know that they may not know about with regard to keeping plants alive kind of versus fish? You know, what would be some of your tips?
This is my absolute favorite topic. So the number one thing that I think anybody, whatever their level of being in the aquarium world is, CO2 is your best friend when it comes to plants. Regardless if you're a beginner or you've been doing this for decades, if you want the best out of your plants, you need to start running pressurized CO2. And I emphasize the word pressurized because there's a lot of products on the market that are called liquid CO2 or CO2 tablets, stuff like that. And what those products are, they're actually a glutahydrate, which is a medical sterilization enzyme that they use in enclaves to sterilize medical equipment. And the way they interact with your plants is they make ferrous or iron more uptakeable by your plants. They don't add any CO2 to the water. And, you know, so they're not doing what you think they're doing. So pressurized CO2 would be actual pressurized gas inside of a cylinder that you're injecting into your aquarium via a regulator and a diffuser or a reactor. And the reason why I stress this so much is CO2 is the main nutrient for photosynthesis. That would be, you know, just to parallel that with us, that would be like if we took, say, all the magnesium and calcium out of our diets, you know, we would be lacking a lot as far as function and pretty much everything. So CO2 is extremely important for them. So I guess, you know, my biggest push is to dive into it. You know, if you're starting your first planted aquarium, if you start with CO2, it's no different than, you know, when you first learn how to ride a bike and you take your training wheels off. Like, it's just a one more little thing that you have to just quickly learn. And there's not much to it. It's for the most part, set it and forget it. But that's a whole another conversation. And then the second would be fertilizers. A lot of people want to believe that their plants are going to live off of fish poop. And that they're just going to sit there and do the thing and grow happy and healthy because their fish are in there and they're feeding their fish and their fish are creating waste. Fish waste provides, you know, one or two nutrients to these plants. And there's overall 16 micro and macronutrients that a plant needs to properly grow. So, I mean, you're getting phosphate and you're getting nitrate from your fish and your poo. So there's 14 others that you're missing. So when people come into the store and they show me pictures of their tanks that, you know, their plants are struggling or they have algae and things like that, usually the number one thing I find is that they aren't dosing fertilizers. And, you know, that, you know, a simple dose of fertilizer can fix so many issues that people struggle with, even algae. A lot of algae is formed due to imbalance in your planted aquarium, nutrient imbalances. And the fertilizers level that out because the plants are now able to uptake all of the waste and things that you wanted them to do because they have the nutrients they need to process this waste. So the third thing is going to be substrate. Substrate really plays a huge role. All of these plants grow roots, even the epiphytes and rhodophytes, those guys grow roots. And those roots are used to uptake nutrients. And if you're using an inert substrate that has no CEC or no ability to retain nutrients, those plants are going to be deprived. You know, they're not going to have an ability to establish what they need to establish subterraneously because they rely on bacteria and all sorts of things to convert this waste over to an uptakeable form. So if those bacteria aren't present, they're not going to be able to uptake the waste. And those bacteria form best in deeper layers of soils. So aqua soils are really what I would promote for people who want to have successful planted aquariums. You can grow sand, and there are people out there who have plenty of success in growing in sand and such, but they're supplementing a lot with root tabs and things like that, or really dosing the column heavy with fertilizer. So the plants are getting their nutrients through precipitants falling into the substrate and such like that. But, so, I mean, if you want an easier route, substrate would be aqua soil because it has the nutrients, it can retain nutrients, and it also absorbs nutrients. So, you know, there's no reason to start with a handicap. Just, you know, set the tank up with the aqua soil, use a good fertilizer. I recommend APT because it's complete, has everything you need in it as far as micro and macronutrients. And get gas going, you know, crank some gas into the aquarium. It's beneficial all around. As far as people worrying about killing their fish and stuff, I mean, start low. You know, you'll start low and observe. This is an observational hobby. Observe your fish, observe your plants. If your fish are gasping, lower the gas. If your plants aren't purling or they're not reacting, up the gas. So, I mean, it's just an observational based hobby. There is science behind it. You can get into it if you want, but really just noticing and paying attention to your environment is key.
That's great. Great advice. And as you started talking about each of those things, I'm thinking, yeah, each of those is probably like another couple hours discussion. But I appreciate, yeah, you mentioning all those. This is kind of just a general question for like people that are keeping fish as well. I'm just curious, like, and I know it's probably going to vary depending on the plants and, you know, your setup and everything. But like, what kind of pHs do you sort of see with your CO2 additions? Like, is there sort of a pH you're shooting for, or is it really vary depending on what's happening?
So it varies on the environment. So pH correlates with your KH, which KH correlates with your CO2 injection. So CO2 is acidic. It will first, before it even affects your pH, it has to eat away at your carbonate, so your KH in your tank. So if you have a very, very high KH, say like 7 would be high in my world, and in some people's worlds it's not. But if you have like a KH of 7 and you're injecting gas, you're going to need to inject more gas into your aquarium to start to get that pH to drop. And I use pH drop, or the actual pH dropping, as an indicator that my environment has the CO2 in it. It's working. It's in there. It's doing its thing. It's eating the carbon. It's therefore now it's affecting the pH, which means it's now dissolving into my environment. So I run some of my tanks at like a pH of 5. That would be like somewhat of a low point, but a lot of the fish I used to breed, including Discus, Epistogramma, Rummy Nose, Cardinal Tetras, all these fish I used to breed, some of them don't prompt into spawning until like a 4.5 pH. So it's mainly about, again, your starting environment and where you go from there with what fish you choose.
Okay. So, I think you kind of talked about it a little bit already, but with regard to what about like lighting and other parameters, what would people be thinking about?
So lighting's going to correlate heavily into the colors you're going to kick out. So if you're looking for that bright reds, the bright pinks and stuff like that you see, you're going to need, you know, higher light. The light reacts with the plant. Basically, the plant will displace its chlorophyll inside of itself to prevent itself from being burned, because most lights are real heavy in the green spectrum or the white spectrum, which is absorbed heavily by, they're heavy in the blue spectrum and red spectrum and the white spectrum, which is absorbed heavily by green. So to prevent themselves from burning, they'll displace their chlorophyll and they'll make these colors. Lighting affects the color of the plants and as also their growth pattern. You know, if you have a higher light or a stronger light on your aquarium, you're going to get tighter, more dense growth, less stretching on the inner nodes. So you'll get nice compact plants. Whereas if you have, you know, not so powerful of a light or not so intense of a light, they're going to stretch. You know, the aquatic plant's goal, really, I tell this to a lot of people, is to get out of the aquarium. You know, they want to get out of the aquarium, out into the air where there's unlimited CO2, no limiting factors, no light degradation due to the water. They know this, and they know that there's more better things for them outside of the water. So by providing them ample light under the water, you're almost tricking them into believing with the correlation of CO2 that they have what they need. They don't need to stretch. They don't need to do this. So lighting will play a big role in keeping your plants compact, keeping them colorful, all of that. And, you know, you can go the wrong way with it and blast it with too much light and even start to sunburn your red plants and stuff. So there's definitely a happy medium there. I primarily run weak aqua lights on aquascapes and stuff like that, mainly because every spectrum on that light is controllable. I can adjust the intensity of every color spectrum and manufacture the look that I want, as well as the intensity that I want, which helps me make the fish look better and it helps make the plants look better and keeps the environment stable.
So obviously sounds like the things you mentioned earlier, including the right substrate and everything, are key to probably a lot of plants. But let's say if you had to kind of choose maybe easy plants to start with, what would you recommend to people that would still kind of give them the ability to have some sort of scape?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, sand, growing in sand is possible as long as you use root tabs. But if you're looking for easy plants universally that will grow anywhere, no matter what the case, I mean, like the Anubias genus. That genus is very hardy. It grows very well in any substrate. Ludwigia repens is a weed by nature. It's a native plant here to Florida, and it will grow just about anywhere in anything. There's lots of water column feeders or more heavier water column feeders like Hygrophylla deformis, which is known as wisteria. Wisteria can grow in anything. It is a very bulletproof plant. Water sprites, that whole category, there's a few different water sprites. Those guys grow really well. Microsorums or Java ferns, it's another very easy plant, can grow epiphytically or can grow on the substrate. CO2 is not really a high demand for it. It can grow pretty well without it and in any kind of substrate. All of those guys are pretty easy. Cryptocorians, they like nutrients in the substrate, but again, I've had people grow them in, you know, clay-based substrates and stuff like that, no problem. So it's really trial and error when it comes to it as far as what plants will work, because I've had some people grow plants that I swear wouldn't do well in non-CO2 environments or not specified environments, and they grow fine in their tanks. So, I mean, I guess my biggest advice is for people to try it, you know, and don't get discouraged if it dies. Just to touch on that for a quick second, like I can grow all the plants I can grow because I killed them a handful of times, you know. I learned that, you know, there's never going to be a finite way to make these plants grow 100% every time. You know, every time's a little bit different, and you kind of have to tweak things here and there. With everything, with every tank I set up, you know, because the rocks are going to affect the chemistry. So you have to tweak something here or there. So my biggest advice to people looking for easy plants is to just try what you like. And there's always something similar. If you failed with that plant, you could try a plant that looks just like it. That's probably going to be incrementally easier. But that failure has led to a lot of success. They're more so learning opportunities than failures.
Great, great advice. So let's talk a little bit now about the kind of the next level. Can you explain what aquascaping is and maybe, whatever the major groups of aquascape are, if you can kind of describe these for folks?
For sure. Aquascaping is an art. Aquascaping is art. There's not a better way to describe it. It is living art. It's ever evolving. Every day it's different. You know, you see these photographs online of competition tanks. That's literally a split second in time for that aquarium. It's that aquarium that you saw, for example, the IAPLC results just got released. And the grand prize winning tank is absolutely beautiful. And today it looks probably even better than it did in the photograph that it was taken a week ago. Something you saw on Instagram, you know, you see a nice, and, you know, the artist, when they're creating this, is they're not necessarily trying to replicate the whole scene or replicate, you know, an environment, more so trying to put forth the inspiration that they felt from this scene or from this actual piece of nature into their aquarium to inspire the artist or to inspire the viewer to feel the same way that the artist felt when they were looking at this piece of nature. That would be naturescapes in a nutshell. The next would be Iwagumi. And Iwagumi is probably one of the more strict guidelines or more strict rules for the Iwagumi tank. It has a set number of stones, and each stone is represented by, you know, a name, and that name has a meaning in Japanese. And those stones have various characteristics that, you know, basically decide where they're being placed in said aquarium. So, I mean, your larger stone, you know, your biggest stone is going to be, you know, the main forefront of this aquarium. And then the other stones are all going to be kind of supporting stones, helping that stone tell its story. Planting an Iwagumi is very simple, usually, you know, 2 to 3 species at max, very limited in planting, because again, the focus isn't the plants in this style. It's more so these stones. You're allowing these stones to tell their story. Iwagumi, in my opinion, is one of the hardest forms to master, yet it's one of the most simplest looking forms of aquarium. It is a beautiful, beautiful style. Next would be like biotopes. And biotopes, pretty self-explanatory. You're taking, again, a piece of nature, and you are replicating it exactly down to the, you know, chemistry of the water, the type of sand that is these fish are living atop, the types of wood that they're swimming around, the types of plants they're living in, all of that is to be replicated, you know, verbatim. And that's a biotope. Biotopes are fun because you actually get to see true nature. You know, to go back to naturescapes, those are extremely well manicured, taken care of, and, you know, designed to be beautiful pieces of art. Biotopes sometimes can look like algae pits, but at the same time, they're beautiful because that's nature. I spent a lot of time snorkeling various freshwater rivers and even went into a few canals in my life. And I can tell you that algae is a part of it. Algae is nature. A lot of fish rely on algae for a diet. So when you see biotopes and you see them covered in algae and you think, oh, no, that's beautiful. It's art. It is literally what has been designed out in nature by whatever greater power did what they did. Biotopes are special to me for that reason, just because of how true nature they are. And then you get into, you know, even more manicured world in the aquariums, which would be Dutch style aquariums. And Dutch style aquariums are, if you could imagine like a Dutch tulip garden or something along those lines, how manicured and the lines and separation between the various species of plants, all that correlates into Dutch aquascaping as well. With Dutch aquascaping, there's very strict rules. So like, let's say you have a 90 centimeter tank. The biggest rule is that you have one plant species per 10 centimeters of tank space or tank width. So in a 90 centimeter tank, you can have 9 species of plants, and they allow you to have 2 extra as kind of like curtain plants and stuff like that. So probably get away with 11, but you have to create a lot of contrast and depth with these 11 or 9 species of plants in this 90 centimeter aquarium. So the layout becomes a bit tricky. You have to know the growth patterns of these plants, because some plants are going to grow like weeds and some plants are going to grow very slow. So when it comes to your horticultural skills and trimming and stuff like that, you really have to be on top of it and know these plants. You have to do a lot of research on them and stuff to realize that, you know, plant A is going to grow 3 inches a week, plant B is only going to grow an inch. So you have to account for that when you want to take your final photo, as far as when these plants are going to be all at their peaks and all looking their best. Dutch to me is my absolute favorite style of aquarium, mainly because of the way you have to work with the plants. You can't really rail against them in that. You'll be able to tell at the end of it that you worked against them instead of with them. And then there's the newest one is garden style, which is kind of like a modified Dutch. This is something that came about in the last few years that was born out of collectoritis. Honestly, it's really kind of like a beautiful painting of aquatic plants. There's no rules as far as placement. There's no rules as far as species limit, anything like that. And they look absolutely beautiful. Those are the tanks that are you see most primarily, I believe, on Instagram, if you're scrolling through any kind of aquascaping feed. And that's because of the colors. The colors in these plants are absolutely astounding that they're able to pull through in garden style aquascapes. And it's, in my opinion, another mastery of the aquatic world with garden style scapes emerging as popular as they are.
Actually, I knew a couple of those, but I didn't, I wasn't familiar with all of those. That's quite a few different kind of approaches. Since we're running out of time, and I could go on for another hour or two, obviously more with you. Can you tell us your favorite win about the competition in a couple minutes?
Yeah, so my favorite win actually was at Aquashella in Orlando, I believe in 2019, either 2019 or 2020. No, it was 19 because they didn't have it in mind. 2019, I was working with Grant Eater and Brian Cubney and Shelby Kay, and it was awesome job working as a team, honestly. Like we just all had a role in doing what we were doing, and the scape came together so well. And still to this day, I feel like that scape that we did is one of my favorite scapes that I had a hand in. And it just felt so good. It was really like one of my first like big competition wins, and totally wasn't expecting it. So it came out of nowhere, and it felt really, really good to have that. And I guess like the biggest thing that made it special to me was all the people, because it was a live event. We had crowds of people around us watching us build this scape, asking us questions, getting inspired, videotaping us, filming us, everything. And after the show, after we had won, my inbox on Instagram and Facebook had multiple messages in it thanking me for the inspiration, thanking me for taking the time to show them various techniques that we were using on the scape. Telling me how I inspired them to up their game or inspired them even to start their first aquascape. And, I'm getting a little emotional even thinking about it, but that's like why I do what I do. That is it. That is it. The inspiration and bringing people into this hobby and showing them what's possible in the aquarium world and sharing the love for this hobby and the respect that it has and that I have for it. Sorry, getting teared up a little bit.
Oh, no, that's beautiful. Yeah, I'll have to look that up, or you'll have to send me the pictures. And I know a couple of those folks, I've had Grant on, and so I assume you had a lot of shrimp on some shrimp in the tank if Grant was involved.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, we dumped like 150 cherry reds in there. It was awesome watching them do their shrimp stuff, skirt around the tank and all that. It added so much life to the aquarium.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, again, we'll definitely have to have you on again, and we'll talk more about aquascaping and maybe get a little bit more even into the competitions. But we are out of time, unfortunately. I want to thank our guest, Chance Kramer, and our producer, Mark Winter, for making this show possible. So, Chance, do you have any words of wisdom or final thoughts?
Yeah, don't get discouraged by failure in this hobby. Every failure in one aquarium is, the key to success in your next aquarium. Look at everything as a learning experience as opposed to a failure, and crank the gas. Get the CO2 going. You want to be successful with aquatic plants. If you want to have an aquascape that looks like an IAPLC, top 100 tank, the key to this is CO2. I can't stress that enough. Your best friend in this world, just dive right into it and crank that gas. I can't say that enough.
Okay, great. Well, thanks. Well, please be sure to check out Chance's web links. Chance will make sure we got all your web links found on his Aquarium Mania episode page. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for a show, email me at drroy@petliferadio.com. That's drroy@petliferadio.com. Until next time, please visit your local aquarium stores, keep your tanks clean and healthy, and definitely consider upping your aquarium keeping game with aquascaping.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.